Indian trail that fell down a long descending valley. Along the way, he saw and described the Rocky Mountain maple, the skunkbush sumac, and the common snowberry. He stopped to collect seeds of the snowberry for Mr. Jefferson. At 9 miles, Lewis saw two Indian women, a man, and some dogs. When he had arrived within half a mile of them, he ordered Driar and the two privates to halt, unslung his pack and rifle and put them on the ground, unfurled a flag, and advanced alone at a steady pace toward the Indians. The women retreated, but the man stayed in place until Lewis was within 100 yards. Lewis called out, "Tababone," loudly and frequently. The man absconded. Lewis had his men join him and proceeded. The country was cut by some short and steep ravines. After less than a mile, topping a rise, they came on 3 Indian women, one a 12-year-old, one a teen, and the third elderly, only 30 yards away. At the first sight, Lewis laid down his rifle and advanced on the group. The teen ran off, but the old woman and the child remained. Seeing no chance to escape, they sat on the ground and held their heads down. To Lewis, it looked as though they had reconciled themselves to die. He approached and took the elderly woman by the hand, raised her up, said, "Tababone," and rolled up his shirt sleeve to show her his white skin. His hands and face were so deeply tanned he might have been an Indian, and his clothes were entirely leather. Driar and the privates joined him. From their packs he gave the woman some beads, a few moccasin awls, a few mirrors, and some paint. His skin and the gifts, and his friendly attitude, were enough to calm her down. Through Driar's sign language, he asked her to call the teen back, fearing that otherwise the girl might alarm the main body of Shoshones. The old woman did as he asked, and the teen reappeared. Lewis gave her some trinkets and painted the tawny cheeks of the women with some vermilion. When the Indians were composed, Lewis told them, through Driar, that he wished them to conduct us to their camp, that we were anxious to become acquainted with the chiefs and warriors of their nation. They did as requested, and the group set off, the Indians leading. After 2 miles, the long-anticipated and eagerly sought contact took place. 60 warriors, mounted on excellent horses and armed for war with bows and arrows plus 3 inferior rifles, came on at full speed. When they saw Lewis's party, they halted. This was the first time an American had ever seen a Shoshone war party, and the first time this band of Shoshones had ever seen an American. The Indians were overwhelmingly superior. It would have been the work of only a moment for them to overwhelm Lewis's party, and they would have more than doubled their firepower in rifles and gathered as loot more knives, awls, looking glasses, and other trinkets than any Rocky Mountain Indian band had ever seen. But rather than assuming a defensive position, Lewis laid down his rifle, picked up his flag, told his party to stay in place, and following the old woman who was guiding, advanced slowly toward he knew not what. A man Lewis assumed was the chief rode in the lead. He halted to speak to the old woman. She told him that these were white men, and exultingly showed the presents which had been given. This broke the tension. The chief and then the warriors dismounted. The chief advanced, saying, "Ahai, ahai," which Lewis later learned meant, "I am much pleased, I am much rejoiced." The chief put his left arm over Lewis's right shoulder and applied his left cheek to Lewis's right cheek, continuing to frequently vociferate the word "Ahai." The warriors and Lewis's men then came on, and we were all caressed and besmeared with their grease and paint till I was heartily tired of the national hug. This first meeting between Shoshones and Americans went better than Lewis could have dared to hope. He had been exceedingly lucky. The war party had ridden out in response to the alarm given by the man who had fled earlier that day. The Shoshones expected to find Blackfeet and might have attacked without pause, save for the old woman. Had Lewis not met her, and had she not responded so positively to his appeals and gifts, there might well have been a firefight. Instead, there was a parley. Lewis brought out his pipe and sat, indicating to the Indians that they should do the same. They did, but not without removing their moccasins, a custom among the Shoshones to indicate sincerity in friendship, or, as Lewis put it, which is as much to say that they wish they may always go barefoot if they are not sincere, a pretty heavy penalty if they are to march through the plains of their country. Lewis lit and passed the pipe. After smoking several rounds, he distributed some presents. The Shoshones were much pleased, particularly with the blue beads and vermilion. Lewis learned that the chief's name was Kamiawait. Lewis told him that the object of our visit was a friendly one, that after they reached Kamiawait's camp, he would explain the expedition more fully, including who we were, from whence we had come, and whither we were going. He gave Kamiawait an American flag, which I informed him was an emblem of peace among white men, to be respected as the bond of union between us. Kamiawait spoke to his warriors, and soon the entire party set out for the main camp. He sent some youngsters ahead to inform the others to prepare for their arrival. When they reached the camp, on the east bank of the Lemhi River, about 7 miles north of today's Tendoy, Idaho, Lewis was ushered into an old leather teepee, the only one the band had left after the Blackfoot raid, and ceremoniously seated on green boughs and antelope skins. After the ritual smoking, I now explained to them the objects of our journey, etc. How well the Shoshones could comprehend a trip across the continent, or if they could even conceive of the continent, Lewis did not say. He was confident the sign language Driar was using was understood, even though he realized it was imperfect and liable to error. Still, the strong parts of the ideas are seldom mistaken. Women and children crowded around, eager to see these children of the Great Spirit. Lewis distributed the presents he had left to the delight of the Shoshones. One Shoshone warrior later described the mirrors as things like solid water, which were sometimes brilliant as the sun and which sometimes showed us our faces. By this time, it was growing dark. Lewis and his men had not eaten in 24 hours. He mentioned this to Kamiawait, who said he was sorry, but the band had nothing but berries to eat. He gave the white men some cakes of service berries and choke cherries. "Of these, I made a hearty meal," Lewis wrote. He strolled down to the Lemhi River and found it a rapid, clear stream about 40 yards wide and 3 feet deep. Through Driar's signs, Lewis inquired about the course of the stream. Kamiawait replied that a half-day's march north, it joined with another, twice as large, coming in from the southwest, forming today's Salmon River. On further questioning, Kamiawait said there was little timber along the river below, that the river was confined between inaccessible mountains, was very rapid and rocky insomuch that it was impossible for us to pass either by land or water down this river to the Great Lake, where the white men lived, as he had been informed. Kamiawait was referring to the traders who called at the mouth of the Columbia River. His description of the salmon was as accurate as it was unwelcome. It confirmed what Lewis must have feared when he first gazed on the Bitterroots from Lemhi Pass. There was no all-water route, or anything remotely resembling it, across the continent. But Lewis dared to hope that this was untrue, suspecting that Kamiawait was only trying to detain the Americans for trading purposes. In fact, as Lewis should have known from Sacagawea, it was time for Kamiawait's band to cross the divide to meet other bands of Shoshones and Flatheads to go on a hunt in the Missouri River buffalo country. Having lied to the chief about the meaning of the flag and being prepared to tell more lies if necessary to meet his aims, Lewis was ready to believe the worst about Kamiawait. The distressing information about the salmon was somewhat balanced for Lewis by the sight of a great number of horses feeding in every direction around their camp. Driar later counted 400 of them. Assuming he could trade for an adequate number of horses, Lewis had little doubt but we shall be enabled to transport our stores, even if we are compelled to travel by land over these mountains. His spirits were further raised when, on his return to his teepee, a warrior gave him a piece of fresh roasted salmon, which I eat with a very good relish. This was the first salmon I had seen, and perfectly convinced me that we were on the waters of the Pacific Ocean. In other words, his positive assertion the previous day that he had first tasted the waters of the Columbia after crossing Lemhi Pass had been more an expression of hope than a certain fact. For all he knew, the Lemhi Salmon River might have been a tributary of the Dearborn River. That night, the Shoshones entertained Lewis and party with a dance. It lasted almost to dawn. At midnight, I grew sleepy and retired to rest, leaving the men to amuse themselves with the Indians. I was several times awoke in the course of the night by their yells, but was too much fatigued to be deprived of a tolerable sound night's repose. With contact made, Lewis now had to give Clark time to come up the Jefferson as far as the fork that marked the extreme limit of navigation, if that limit had not already been passed. Clark was making only 4 or 5 miles a day in the shallow, boulder-covered bed of the Jefferson, which was not much more than a large creek. Lewis decided to spend the morning of August 14th writing in his journal, the afternoon in procuring further information from Kamiyawe about the country to the west. He sent Driar and the privates out to hunt. The Indians furnished them with horses, and some 20 young braves joined them. Lewis was treated to a sight few white men ever saw, a chase on horseback by the young Indian hunters after 10 pronghorns. It lasted about 2 hours and considerable part of the chase in view from my tent. The hunters returned. They had not killed a single antelope, and their horses foaming with sweat. When Driar returned, equally unsuccessful, Lewis used his sign language ability to ask Kamiyawe to instruct me with respect to the geography of his country. The chief repeated what he had said the previous day, with more details. After drawing a waving line on the ground to represent the river, he plied sand on each side of it to represent the vast mountains of rock eternally covered with snow through which the river passed. He spoke of perpendicular and even jutting rocks so closely hemmed in the river that there was no possibility of passing along the shore. The whole surface of the river was beat into perfect foam as far as the eye could reach, that the mountains were also inaccessible to man or horse. How, then, to cross those mountains? Kamiyawe said he had never done it, but there was an old man in his band who could probably give me some information of the country to the northwest. He added that he had understood from the pierced-nosed Indians who inhabit this river below the Rocky Mountains that it ran a great way toward the setting sun and finally lost itself in a great lake of water which was illy tasted. That sentence linked the continent. For the first time, a white man had a map, however imperfect and imprecise, to connect the great rivers of the Western Empire. Also for the first time, a white man heard of the Nez Perces, the major tribe living west of the mountains. Kamiyawe added that the Nez Perces crossed to the Missouri River buffalo country to hunt each year. What route did they use? Lewis asked. It was to the north, the chief answered, but added that the road was a very bad one, as he had been informed by them, and that they had suffered excessively with hunger on the route, being obliged to subsist for many days on berries alone, as there was no game in that part of the mountains which were broken, rocky, and so thickly covered with timber that they could scarcely pass. Far from being downcast by such a description, Lewis was encouraged. "My route was instantly settled in my own mind," he wrote. "I felt perfectly satisfied that if the Indians could pass these mountains with their women and children, that we could also pass them." This is a wonderful sentence. It shows his complete confidence in himself, Captain Clark, and the men. He is not boasting or challenging, just being matter-of-fact about it. If they can, we can. It also shows Lewis's and Clark's ability to get more out of the men than the men ever thought they could give. Ascending the Missouri in the keelboat, the bitter cold winter at Mandan, the awful labor at the Great Falls Portage, the incredible labor getting the canoes up the Jefferson, every time they had such an experience behind them, the men agreed that it had to be the worst, and that they could not possibly endure anything worse. Only to have it get worse. But well-led men working together can do far more than they ever thought they could, especially if they are in life-threatening situations, which was exactly where Lewis intended to lead them. He dared to do so because he knew they had more in them than they thought, and he knew how to bring out the best in them. Kamiyawe had more information. He said there were no buffalo west of the mountains, that the Indians who lived there subsisted on salmon and roots. He complained about the Spanish policy of never selling guns to Indians, whereas the English sold guns to the Blackfeet, Hidatsas, and other enemies of the Shoshones. With that advantage in firepower, the Plains Indians were continually harassing the Shoshones, who were forced to hide in the interior of the mountains most of the year. But, Kamiyawe added, With his fierce eyes and lank jaws grown meager for the want of food, such would not be the case if we had guns. We could then live in the country of buffalo and eat as our enemies do. Here was the opening Lewis sought. Here was the opportunity to make promises that would induce Kamiyawe to help with the portage over the Continental Divide and to trade for horses that could get the expedition over the Bitterroots on the Nez Perce route. Lewis said that he had already induced the Hidatsas to promise that they would no longer raid against the Shoshones or make war on any of their neighbors, even though he knew that the Hidatsas had sent out a war party that spring, and that when the expedition got to the Pacific and then returned to the United States, white men would come to them, the Shoshones, with an abundance of guns and every other article necessary to their defense and comfort. Since the expedition was now more than 3,000 river miles from St. Louis, that was a promise for an uncertain future. He made it anyway. Lewis told Kamiyawe that he wanted the band to cross Limhi Pass with him in the morning, bringing 30 horses, to meet with Clark and the main party at the forks of Jefferson River and help bring the baggage over the pass and down to the Indian camp on the Limhi River, where we would then remain some time among them and trade with them for horses. Kamiyawe agreed. He made a lengthy harangue to his village, then told Lewis that everything was settled. They would start in the morning. Lewis was overjoyed. The Shoshone horses, he wrote, were excellent. Indeed, many of them would make a figure on the south side of James River or the land of fine horses. Even better, they had some sure-footed mules. Lewis went to his teepee to sleep in a happy mood. As for the Indians, they were very merry. They danced again this evening until midnight. Lewis woke on the morning of Thursday, August 15th, as hungry as a wolf. The previous day, he had nothing to eat save a scant meal of flour and berries, which had not satisfied him as it appeared to do my Indian friends. He had 2 pounds of flour left. He told McNeil to divide the flour into 2 equal parts and to cook 1/2 mixed with berries. On this new-fashioned pudding, 4 of us breakfasted, giving a pretty good allowance also to the chief, who declared it the best thing he had tasted for a long time. After breakfast, a crisis. The warriors would not move, despite Kamiyawe's urging. Lewis asked after the cause and was told that some foolish persons among them had suggested the idea that we were in league with the Pakis, the Shoshone word for Atsinas, and had come on in order to decoy them into an ambuscade where their enemies were waiting to receive them. Lewis told Kamiyawe that he forgave the warriors their suspicion. I knew they were not acquainted with white men, that among white men it was considered disgraceful to lie or entrap an enemy by falsehood. After that stretcher, Lewis threatened that if the Shoshones did not help with the portage, no white man would come to bring them arms and ammunition. Then he challenged their manhood, saying, I still hope that there were some among them that were not afraid to die. The challenge touched on the right string. To doubt the bravery of a savage is at once to put him on his mettle. Kamiyawe mounted his horse and gave a speech to his people, saying he would go with the white men to convince himself of the truth of what Lewis said. He added that he hoped some at least of the warriors would join him. 6 mounted their horses. The small party set out, even though several of the old women were crying and imploring the Great Spirit to protect their warriors as if they were going to inevitable destruction. The Indians rode on anyway, and soon enough another 6 men and 3 women joined them, making altogether a party of 16 Indians and 4 white men. Lewis was struck by the capricious disposition of those people who never act but from the impulse of the moment. They were now very cheerful and gay, and 2 hours ago they looked as surly as so many imps of Saturn. They crossed Limhi Pass and descended to Shoshone Cove, where they camped on the creek and had their 2nd meal of the day. I now cooked and among 6 of us eat the remaining pound of flour, stirred in a little boiling water. The Shoshones, save Kamiyawe and an unnamed warrior, had nothing to eat that day. The next morning, August 16th, Lewis sent Driar and Shields out to kill some meat. He asked Kamiyawe to keep his young men in camp so that they would not alarm the game. That was a mistake, for it reawakened the suspicions of the Shoshones, They feared the white men were trying to make contact with the Blackfeet, so two parties of warriors set out on each side of the valley to spy on Driar and Shields. Lewis, McNeil, and the remainder of the Shoshones followed. After about an hour, when we saw one of the spies coming up the level plain under whip, the chief paused a little and seemed somewhat concerned. I felt a good deal so myself. Lewis's fear was that by some unfortunate accident, the Blackfeet really were in the neighborhood. But when the scout arrived, breathless, he had good news. Driar had killed a deer. In an instant, they all gave their horses the whip. Lewis was riding double with a young warrior. The Indian was whipping the horse at every jump for a mile, fearing he should lose a part of the feast. As I was without stirrups, the jostling was disagreeable. Lewis reined in his horse and forbade the young man to use the lash. The Indian jumped off and ran on foot at full speed for a whole mile. At the side of the kill, the scene when I arrived was such that, had I not have had a pretty keen appetite myself, I am confident I should not have tasted any part of the venison. Each Indian had a piece of some description and all eating most ravenously. Some were eating the kidneys, the melt, the spleen, and liver and the blood running from the corners of their mouths. Others were in a similar situation with the paunch and guts. One of the last to arrive had provided himself with about 9 feet of the small guts, one end of which he was chewing on, while with his hands he was squeezing the contents out at the other. I really did not until now think that human nature ever presented itself in a shape